Hello and welcome to episode 33 of Not Reserving Judgment, a podcast about the latest intrigues, triumphs, and outrages in Canadian constitutional law. I'm Josh LaHaas, counsel with the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
And I'm Christine Van Gine, the CCF's litigation director. Joanna is away today. In today's episode, I'll tell you about a new court decision that struck down parts of an Ontario law that was aimed at keeping animal activists from going undercover on farms to expose cruelty against animals.
And we'll share our bad legal takes of the week, where we take a lighthearted look at some legal opinions that didn't quite land. But first, I'm going to tell you about new legislation from British Columbia that could have far-reaching consequences if you consume or intend to consume or sell any products in British Columbia. So, Christine, I mentioned this new BC bill to you a few weeks ago, and I still can't get over the sheer breadth of this thing. And the bill is called the Public Health Accountability and Cost Recovery Act, and hidden behind that boring name is like a huge expansion of government powers. So, as our listeners probably know, the common law includes something called tort law, and torts is a course I got a C+ in law school, so I can't really tell you all that much about it, but according to Wikipedia, a tort is a civil wrong that causes a claimant to suffer loss or harm resulting in legal liability. And the most common tort is negligence, which arises when someone owes a duty of care to another person. The defendant breaches that duty of care by an act or omission, and the plaintiff suffers some damages. So the most common is like a car accident. If somebody drives carelessly, it's reasonably foreseeable that, you know, they're going to hit somebody else and cause them injuries. And if they do, that person can sue and get money that can make them whole again. It also arises a lot in product liability. And in fact, the very first case in tort law was a product liability case. A famous case about a woman in England who was sickened by snail in the ginger ale. Christine, I'm sure you know the case I'm talking about.
Yes, it's really gross, the concept of drinking a snail.
Yes, and now we don't have to worry about drinking snails in our ginger ale because of tort law, which, you know, makes corporations worry that they're going to be on the hook if they create products that are not safe. And these principles have served us really well for over a century, and we no longer need like heavy-handed government regulations in a lot of industries because companies know that they'll be on the hook if they create unsafe products. But this BC law plans to sort of like push aside those well-established tort law principles and stack the decks severely in the government's favor whenever the government wants to sue somebody and try and get money out of them. And, you know, this new bill would allow the government to recover money in cases where any product or service has caused merely a risk of a disease, injury, or illness. And it's modeled after some other pieces of legislation that were created to make it easier for governments to sue and win against tobacco companies when they caused harm that led to costs in the healthcare system, and also opioid drug creating companies, which have led to the opioid crisis. Now, those laws were controversial enough without it applying to any and all products. And one of the things that makes these laws controversial is that they create these presumptions in favor of the government, including the presumption that people wouldn't have been exposed to the product had the companies not breached some sort of duty to them, as if, you know, people don't have any human agency about whether or not to use products that are risky or that turn out to be risky in the long term. And it also allows governments to merely present some statistics that show that some harm was likely caused. So they don't actually have to prove causation like they normally would in most tort law cases. A third thing that it does is allows governments to have like really long limitations periods. So if you or I want to sue somebody, we might have like a 2-year limitation period, but the government is going to give themselves 15 years to sue and recover money. And this is going to cause nearly every type of business imaginable to reevaluate whether they even want to do business in places like British Columbia. And we're already seeing a pretty huge reaction from business groups like the Greater Vancouver Board of Trade, ringing the alarm bells, and for good reason, because like who would want to sell a product in British Columbia if you can be liable for even the mere risk that it's going to cause somebody harm in the distant future? So the government has talked about this. They came out and they said this is about social media companies and the harms that they allegedly cause to children, but it applies not just to children, it applies to everybody, including adults. And it's hard to even imagine like a way to reduce to zero the risk of harm from something like social media because there's just so much information on there and there's always going to be some sort of risk. So I don't know, to me it seems more about like whether the parents are doing their jobs than anything. And
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Don't give your daughter Instagram when she's nine.
yeah, certainly not nine. I would wait as long as possible, even though I love Instagram, I use it all the time. It's more of a, you know, it's better for older people than younger people. But this also applies to things like vaping companies and, you know, vaping, again, there are some health risks, but there's also benefits, which is that for smokers, a lot of them, it allows them to quit smoking. And as far as we know, it's much healthier to vape than to smoke. And you could see this applying to like sugary or fattening foods. So, you know, if you're a BC, if you're a fast food chain, are you going to want to open up in British Columbia if in the future, you know, 12 years from now, they decide that your products cause health harms and they want to like wring some money out of you? It also probably is concerning to oil and gas because there's no question burning gasoline leads to, you know, some pollution, and the government already regulates that. But now we're going to see activists pushing the government to like sue gas stations and try and just squeeze money out of them. And so I'm not sure if there are like huge constitutional issues involved in this or not. I haven't really had time to like sit down and think through every possible scenario, but it's certainly something that's on our radar and that we thought our listeners and now our viewers, since you can watch this on YouTube now, would be interested in. Christine, what do you think? Do you think this is interesting, or do you share my concerns?
I do. It's one of these like one law for me and one law for thee type of things where the principles of tort law that have served our society well for a really, really long time are now being amended to give special priority to government. And I do have concerns about even like extraterritorial application of this to goods that are brought into British Columbia. But maybe, you know, a company is like, look, we're not going to do business in British Columbia because they've got this crazy regime, which is obviously not good for BC consumers who should be able to choose what risks they want to take. But what if you bring that product into British Columbia, even though the business says that they don't want to do business in that place because of the risks associated with it? What happens there? So I don't know the answer to that. I'm just kind of, this is my reaction to hearing it. I don't know. I don't like this kind of thing. I think that we impose liability on companies for doing bad things. The system that we have has worked well. I don't know that the government needs special heightened rights, and I think that the overall consequence will probably be to the detriment of people of British Columbia. And there's all of this really hyper concern over social media companies, where I think that the point that you made, Josh, that this is a role for parents to get involved. Don't blame everything that if that that your child that happens to your child or that your child does is not it's some sometimes it's the responsibility of parents. That's what parenting is all about. So that's my high level reaction just based on what you've said. I don't know much about this, but it seems like something worth monitoring. So I'll move to my headline, which is about a recent decision from the Ontario Superior Court about the conditions of animals on farms, in slaughterhouses, and for fat farms, kind of like industrial level farming. And the conditions that these animals live in, and the conduct of animal rights activists. So there are these what animal rights activists call ag gag laws. And what these ag gag laws, it's ag because agriculture and gag because it's supposed to silence these activists. So these laws restrict certain ways that activists engage in what they call journalism or whistleblowing or reporting, that they use these tactics to expose animal cruelty and to investigate and report on the agricultural industry where animals are involved, like the meat industry, dairy, egg industry, fur industry. So some of the tactics that activists use are they covertly photograph or film inside farms and slaughterhouses. They sometimes use undercover employees to obtain that footage. They sometimes will interact with and film animals going into slaughterhouses on trucks. So they'll approach one of these large transport trucks that have animals inside. They might give water to the animals. And there's a number of laws in different parts of Canada, but this case dealt with Ontario, that restricts some of those things. And the law at issue is called the Ontario Security from Trespass and Protecting Food Safety Act. And it was enacted in 2020. So the provisions at issue that deal with this undercover reporting and approaching animals and protesting outside of slaughterhouses, there's a whole bunch of different provisions that these animal rights groups have challenged. But one of the provisions requires the consent from the owner or the business occupier of the slaughterhouse or farm to give consent for anyone to be in the facility, to be in that farm or the slaughterhouse. And one section of that act, section 5 of the regulation, it voids consent if it was given under false pretenses. So for example, if an animal rights activist gets a job working on the farm for the purpose of filming animals, the legislation makes it an offense to make any kind of false statement to gain that access. That's in section 9. And if you make a false statement, then the consent of the farm or the slaughterhouse is voided. Section 10 of the regulation makes it an offense to claim a qualification that you don't have to get that job. So one of the ways that the agriculture businesses use these provisions that are all related to one another to weed out animal rights activists is that they will directly ask things like, are you affiliated with an animal rights group when interviewing someone for a job? Or they might ask, do you have a university degree? And if the answer is, and having a university degree is bad, it's actually a way of weeding you out. So to get the job, the animal rights activists would have to lie. They would have to deny having a university degree, or they would have to falsely claim that they are not associated with an animal rights group. And then if they lie, that means that the company's consent was voided under Section 5, and then the employee can be punished for committing an offense under the Act. So they obtained the job under false pretenses, that voids the consent and turns them into a trespasser under the Act. So this was challenged by an animal rights group called Animal Justice, and they argued that these provisions, the ones that void consent and deal with false statements, that they, as well as some others, target animal rights activists who get jobs in the industry to document the treatment of these animals and who then share that footage. Specifically, they argued that they violate the right to freedom of expression. And they also argued that some other provisions, which I'll talk about, also violated the right to freedom of expression. So Ontario said in response that the act is aimed at protecting animal safety, biosecurity, and the safety of farmers, as well as preventing economic harm that might flow from hurting, interfering with animal safety or farmer safety. And they also argued that the charter does not apply, that there's no right to freedom of expression here, because this is all on private property. Now, obviously, that last part I disagree with. Obviously, the charter doesn't apply to private individuals, but it applies to government action like penalties under this law. And sections 9 and 10 of the regulation do put a limit on expression. It's the government limiting the expression and putting a penalty on someone for engaging in expression. And the court did conclude that Section 9, which makes it an offense to make a false statement to gain access, they did say that engages the right to freedom of expression and that it's an overly broad and disproportionate limit. They said, the court said that it penalizes misstatements like denying affiliation with an animal rights group or having a university degree. And they also found that those misstatements don't have any bearing on animal safety or on food security. So they found that it was a violation, this lying about, for example, having a university degree or lying about being associated with an animal rights group. The restrictions on that and the penalties associated with it are a violation of the right to free expression, and they can't be saved under Section 1 of the Charter. They're not a reasonable limit. So the court declared Section 9 to be of no force in effect. Now, that other section that I mentioned, Section 10, which is lying about your qualifications, say you say, I'm a butcher, I'm really good at animal butchery. If you lie about that, they said that that is a violation of Section 2B of the right to freedom of expression, but it is a justified limit because exaggerating your qualifications, for example, saying you know how to use certain industrial equipment, that could endanger animals and it could endanger food security. So they said that that was a justified limit. But there's another part that I mentioned just a minute ago, another aspect of the act that's at issue here. And that's these provisions that actually exempt journalists and whistleblowers from the lying provisions. So basically, you would be exempt from a penalty for lying about your affiliation with an animal rights group or having a university degree, for example, if you are a journalist or a whistleblower. So you won't be prosecuted under those provisions if you lie and you're a journalist. But the animal rights group said that the limits, the exemptions are too narrow. They're too narrow in scope, and they really restrict what's considered a journalist or a whistleblower. And the court found that, yeah, the definition is too restrictive. The definition of journalist in the act is pretty much limited to traditional media. And the court found that this made it minimally impairing to have such a restrictive definition for journalist. But the court did not provide a definition of what a journalist is, which is a longstanding and really interesting question. The court said, they said that a definition of journalism has always been difficult, and they referenced how the Supreme Court has recognized the importance of newer non-traditional media and facilitating broader discussions on matters of public interest, citing this case of Grant and Torstar. So I think that's a really interesting part of the case. They did not, though, define what a journalist is. So we're going to continue to debate that question, I think. So overall, this case is super interesting to me. I've interviewed the animal rights group on my television program, Animal Justice. To be clear, I eat meat and I enjoy eating meat. I think all of us who eat meat would like the animals that we eat to be treated well. No one wants animals to unnecessarily suffer. But I don't know. I have mixed views on the case. I do think that the videos that these groups obtain are important. I think that they're high value expression. I think without video footage, we would have no idea if animal cruelty is taking place. And we do want to restrict animal cruelty. We want our animals that we consume to be treated well and not to be abused. But I also think that there are serious safety issues with filling industrial farms and slaughterhouses with activists. These are not necessarily inherently the safest places. There's a lot of risk associated with the equipment in slaughterhouses and industrial farms. And so I think the case is a really interesting one about balancing this right to expression with protecting this real fundamental safety issue of ensuring that people are not hurt by doing reporting in these places. I also obviously think that the whole discussion over what constitutes a journalist is a really important one that we're going to continue to have for many years as the landscape changes. And I also think that the decision itself, even though I do think that the animal rights groups are probably happy with it, there was only, it's really on a very narrow issue. And it's on this narrow issue of lying, like false pretenses to get access to to the farm or the slaughterhouse. So I don't know what's happening next in the case. I don't know whether the government is going to appeal because they lost on that part, or if the animal rights group is going to appeal because they lost on some parts of this case. But it's certainly something that I'm going to be watching because freedom of expression cases are so interesting to me. Josh, what do you think?
Yeah, I haven't read the decision yet. I can't wait to read it because it sounds absolutely fascinating. And I read all the materials at the time that this decision or that this case was launched. And I just have a few things to add. So, I mean, there's a big issue we haven't really talked about here, which is property rights. And to me, the bill is not aimed, it's aimed partly at expression, but it's also aimed at protecting property rights of farmers who don't want animal activists walking onto their farms in the middle of the night and going to take videos or being hired and under false pretenses so that they can expose whatever it is that they want to expose. So I do think there's more than just expression going on here. And in one sense, I feel like the activists are almost seeking like a positive right to expression rather than, you know, a negative right to not to, you know, not have their expression limited. And I don't know that they're like positive rights for expression are very limited in the case law. So I was kind of surprised. In fact, I was very surprised to see them win on anything. Like I thought this case was a loser for animal justice, and clearly it was not. They've had some success here, and I would expect the government to appeal. One other
What do you
minor
think of
issue.
this argument the government made that the charter doesn't even apply because it's on private property?
Well, I'm not sure. I think based on the case law that it does apply. I thought that was kind of a surprising argument for them to make. But I mean, there are real risks here, and it's not just the ones you mentioned, but there is like the biosecurity risk is real
Yeah.
in not in the part that was struck down, but in the idea that if you have people walking onto farms tracking whatever diseases into that barn, that's a big deal. And animal rights people say, well, we don't want to harm animals, so we take precautions. But like, you don't take all the precautions that farmers take, right? So, anyway, I still have to read the decision, so I shouldn't talk too much about it. But something for sure, I can't wait to dig into. Let's have a little break, and when we come back, I'll do my bad legal take, and then you can do yours, Christine.
Great.
Hi, I'm Russell from the CCF. In case you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our email newsletter, The Freedom Update, to get updates from me every week about our ongoing work and the legal stories in Canada that keep us interested. Along with our new podcast, Not Reserving Judgment, it's one of the best ways to stay up to date. Subscribe at theccf.ca/freedomupdate.
So my bad legal take goes to a Toronto couple who says their stunning arts and crafts home in an exclusive neighborhood should not be designated a heritage home because the original owner was, wait for it, racist. Now, this 9,000 square foot home was built for someone named Stapleton Pitt Caldicott, who it turns out there is evidence was anti-immigrant before he died in 1907. And its new owners are a mixed race couple. One of them is a doctor of Sri Lankan descent. The other one's an actor who has some roots in Pakistan. She was on The Real Housewives of Toronto. And their claim is that this home shouldn't be heritage designated because it celebrates a man who had racist views in 1906 at a time when everyone had racist views. And their lawyers suggested they might make a human rights complaint, but obviously their real goal is to remove the heritage designation because heritage designations can, you know, slow down attempts to renovate and they can restrict like what you can do to the property to some degree. And the city responded to this by saying that the heritage designation is not about the original owner. It's about this beautiful house's unique architecture. And just in case there were any doubts about that, the city actually already removed references to the original owner, but surprise, surprise, this hasn't placated the couple. And the doctor actually spoke to the Heritage Committee where he said that merely what the city had done was merely putting our thumbs over that part of history, and that the only appropriate remedy is to repeal the bylaw that gave the heritage home its designation in the first place. And the funny thing to me about this entire claim is that, you know, they purchased a $5 million century home and they didn't even look into whether it was heritage designated. And I may have gotten a C+ in torts, but I got a B+ in real estate law. And I know one of the first things you check, even if it's not a $5 million, century home, is whether there's a heritage designation, and it's right there on the title. So I have a really hard time to, believing that they didn't know this was heritage protected. I think they almost certainly did. And I do tend to have some sympathy for property owners who face onerous paperwork if they want to renovate heritage homes or heritage buildings, because heritage designations do impinge on property rights. And it might even be arguable that they constitute a taking of sorts of those property rights if the designation, lowers the value of the home so that the property can provide the public with some benefit, an aesthetic benefit that's valuable to the public without having, compensated the property owner for that. But I just can't make myself feel bad for a couple who can afford a $5 million home and claims that they're the victim of some ghost of some man who was anti-immigrant in the Victorian era. And I'm also just super jealous of them, Christine. And that's why this is my bad legal take this
Yeah,
week.
this is like world's tiniest violin level stuff. Like Roxy, you won. You live in his house. It's worth $5 million. You're a celebrity. I think you're not an oppressed person at this point. And also, what my understanding is relatively easy to get a permit to make a rent an amendment to your heritage home. I think what they want to do is change the steps. And I have no reason to think it wouldn't have been approved. So I don't know. My favorite comment on this was claiming racism for a heritage designation is a god level hack for building housing in San Francisco. And it's like, if you actually want to build something in that city, maybe this would work.
It's worth a try.
Yeah, sure. I think anything is at this point. Okay, so my bad legal take is about the eclipse. I'm big on the eclipse right now. And there have been so many bad legal takes about the eclipse emergency. And I'll say I went to see the eclipse with my family because they were all not in school. So I had to take care of them yesterday. So we went to see the eclipse and I loved it. I'm not an eclipse hater. I'm an eclipse lover. It was very magical, but it was not an emergency at all.
It was an emergency for me. I couldn't see for 2 hours afterwards.
Oh, you're not supposed to stare directly into the sun.
I know that now.
News flash. So as we discussed last week, Niagara region declared a state of emergency over the eclipse. So there have been a whole lot of bad legal takes around this. First, the Niagara regional chair said they needed an emergency out of an abundance of caution because they expected 1 million people. And I said last week that I would eat my words if 1 million people showed up because there was zero indication about how the region got to that number. It seems like they just took their largest previous crowd and multiplied it by 9 or 10 or 8 or 9, maybe. But I don't have to eat my words because 1 million people did not show up. Shock. And the mayor of Niagara Falls says it was about 200,000 people. And the mayor of Niagara Falls also said there was no emergency. He said that on CBC News last night. He isn't the one who declared it. It was the regional chair. The mayor said no emergency. So that's a good legal take. But there were bad legal takes from many people, even after the eclipse, who are still doubling down on this emergency. The regional chair, the one who declared the emergency, said we needed the declaration in case there was an infrastructure collapse or an earthquake. And like, I know that some people view the eclipse as a bad omen, but this is like next level apocalypse stuff. Like, the earth will shake, the sun will hide. I have no idea why he thinks these things would happen. Sometimes my mom obsesses over the worst case scenario of everything. And it's like, oh, we can't do this because, what if there's an earthquake? And this seems to be what Regional Chair Bradley is doing, imagining worst case scenarios based on nothing and just throwing them out there. Another bad legal take I'm going to give to a woman I got into it with on Twitter last night. We had this exchange over the eclipse, and she went to the eclipse and I guess was stuck in very bad traffic coming home. And she said, getting home is when emergency funds are needed. And next time, can we get a state of emergency for QEW traffic? Now, I thought that that was a joke, But it was not. She really was mad about the traffic and said that the traffic itself constituted an emergency. And traffic is not an emergency, people. I am sorry to hear that she had bad traffic to deal with. I go to Niagara every Friday to film my show. I also have to deal with bad traffic in Niagara. But if gridlock was an emergency, we'd be in a perpetual state of emergency in Toronto, in Niagara, all over Canada. This is exactly the type of nonsense that we warned about and why we are having this emergency declaration judicially reviewed. So that's my bad legal take. There should have been no emergency declaration, and traffic, no, it is not an emergency.
All right, I agree. Well, as usual, we hope you'll rate us, review us, and subscribe. And just a reminder that you can support our work by subscribing to the CCF's YouTube channel, by following us on Twitter, by visiting our website where you can sign up for our weekly newsletter called the Freedom Update. And just a reminder, the Canadian Constitution Foundation is a nonpartisan legal charity funded by your donations. So please go to our website and click that blue donate button if you can. Thanks for listening.